Welcome to New Books in World Affairs. This is your host, Christian Peterson. And today I have the good fortune of speaking with Henry Now about his new book, Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy Under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan, which is put out by Princeton University Press. Henry Now, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Christian. It's good to be here.
Henry, to begin, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, where you studied, and how you came up through academia, so to speak.
Sure. Well, I began actually as a engineering student. I grew up, of course, I went to high school in the Sputnik era, and so we were all encouraged to think seriously about science and technology. So I did my undergraduate work at MIT, initially in chemical engineering. Eventually, I wound up in something called physics, science, economics, and politics, which is about as far as you could go in the direction of social sciences at MIT at the time. But I had realized that I wanted to move into more of the social science and history arena. So I went then into the service for a couple of years. I was an ROTC cadet. And after that experience, I went back to graduate school. I did my master's and PhD work at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Studied with Robert Osgood, who is, of course, one of the all-time, great minds in thinking and writing about American foreign policy. And then had my first teaching job at Williams College, eventually came here to George Washington University. I have been in government twice during my teaching career. I've always, my teaching position has always been at GW, but I went into the State Department in 1975 to 1977 as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow, and served as a special assistant to the Undersecretary for Economic Affairs in the State Department. At that time, a gentleman called Chuck Robinson. This was, of course, the last 2 years of the Kissinger era in the State Department. And then I went back into government in 1981, January of 1981, as a senior staff member of the National Security Council in the Reagan administration, charged then with responsibility for international economic affairs, and particularly the economic summits at that time, the G7 summits. I then returned to the university in the fall of 1983 and, continued my teaching and writing and publication career in the academic world.
It's an interesting career. So you've had the experience of teaching at a research university and the small liberal arts kind of academic
Correct.
Environment then. What was it like to teach at Williams College?
It was a terrific teaching experience. That is a wonderful group of very smart, often, not always, but often highly motivated. So it was a real joy to teach. Now, these are my early years of teaching, so it consumed a lot of my energy and thinking at the time, but I really enjoyed that. I must say I was a little less enamored with the environment at Williams and with the faculty. It was a
Sure.
highly, very liberal school, and I was looking, and it was a little bit isolated, being up there in the northwestern corner of Massachusetts. So my wife and I, were ready to move to a more urbanized area where I could also indulge my interest in policy, since I was always
Sure.
interested in the policy scene.
And how much did you run into Richard Pipes when you worked for the Reagan administration?
Yes, no, I did. I knew Richard. I didn't work with him intensely because he was working on the Soviet side of things. And, of course, I was working on sort of the free market world economy side of things. But we did cross paths from time to time on questions of economic sanctions against the Soviet Union, which were significant in the first Reagan term, especially the restraints that we imposed on the export of oil and gas equipment and technology, trying to at least not assist the development of the Soviet gas pipeline that they were putting into place to sell gas to Western Europe. One of the interesting things about the early years on that first term Reagan National Security Council is that the effort was integral. That is, there was a real effort to pull together all of the pieces of national policy and international policy into a grand strategy. That's now, by the way, evident in all the national security decision studies and memoranda that were done during this period from 1981 to 1983. And those who have looked at those documents now carefully have recognized that they laid out, in a sense, the plan, the policies in all kinds of areas, economic, political, propaganda, intelligence, strategic. They laid out military, of course. They laid out the plans that Reagan essentially implemented in his second term after the, you know, economy was revived significantly in 83 and 84. So it's a study in sort of the application of grand strategy to policymaking, a pretty successful one, I would argue.
Yeah, that's interesting. I met Richard Pipes at a conference that he came when I was at Ohio University getting my PhD, and almost before he said anything to me, someone asked him about Soviet revisionist historians, and he out of the blue just got up and said, "Soviet revisionist historians, I invite their scorn." And I'm like, "Whoa, this who is this?" I mean, I knew who he was obviously from the scholarship, but to see, you know, he's an older man just get up, seem like animated by the, you know, the debates about Soviet intentions.
Enormous energy, intellectual firepower. Obviously, he had a story to tell. He had an opinion to, express. And, I think you have to look, work. I mean, I always say to friends, just criticize what he said or what he, you know, what his ideas were, and sort of try to separate out the ad hominem, comments, which are all too frequent, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Especially sometimes when they're, when it's directed at conservatives. I mean, I think of some people like Noam Chomsky, who's just as opinionated, but on the left.
Mm-hmm.
But the charge is seldom made against him that somehow or other he's
the epitome of evil
off the reservation. Yeah.
Yes. So I think that's a good segue to go into your new book, Conservative Internationalism. Mm-hmm. How did you come to write this work?
Well, I, as I say in the acknowledgments of the book, it's been rumbling around in my head from almost the beginning of my, introduction into the field of international studies. When I came to Washington in the mid-60s as a graduate student, I was just struck by the fact that I always came across the word liberal and liberal internationalism. I never came across the word conservative. I did, of course, find realists in the city, sometimes a few nationalists, and often they were thought of as conservatives, but there was no conservative internationalism, someone who genuinely believes in trying to improve the world, that we can move beyond stability, the status quo, anarchy, and we can make the world a better place, largely through the expansion of prosperity and the spread of democracy. There wasn't a tradition of thinking and of writing in that vein. So, you know, for 30, 40 years, I worked on other problems. I started working on technological issues in U.S. foreign policy, drawing on my engineering or my science background. Then I worked on economics and U.S. foreign policy. And then finally, after the Cold War, sort of began to work on grand strategy and American foreign policy. So after I finished a book in 2002 in which I wrestled with my realist training and tried to inject the whole notion of ideas, identity, into a realist framework, that book was called At Home Abroad, Identity and Power in American Foreign Policy. I was ready to kind of do the study that would try to define a conservative internationalist tradition in the field of foreign policy. And in the book, I have a very simple matrix on page 27 in which I illustrate these traditions in terms of their relative emphasis on the goals of foreign policy, namely security versus spreading democracy, and their relative emphasis on the means of foreign policy, force versus diplomacy. And that matrix shows very quickly that three standard traditions, nationalism, realism, liberal internationalism, they pop right out, and they have a well-defined body of literature, and, you know, even institutes in Washington and elsewhere that represent that point of view. But then there's that fourth quadrant, which is conservative internationalism, which is almost empty. almost empty except for, you know, something called neoconservatism that came along in the last three or four decades. And as I say in the book, well, the neoconservatives were kind of looking for this alternative. They were refugees from the liberal internationalist tradition, like, for example, Jean Kirkpatrick, and they were also refugees from the realist position, like Condi Rice. They were looking for something that would combine more integrally force and the desire to improve the international system by increasing the number of democratic regimes. But they didn't define that tradition. That tradition has been left undefined, and I'm hoping that my book will in some measure begin a process of defining that tradition and nurturing that tradition and understanding that tradition, because it's clearly, as that matrix shows, an important element of the debate about American foreign policy and should not be excluded in future debates.
Yeah, your analysis raises a number of thought-provoking questions and related to the idea of conservative internationalism. For our listeners, I think it would make sense to, and you don't have to go into all the details. You have a number of good charts and matrices to show the reader some of the ideas that you develop. But on its most basic level, what is conservative internationalism?
Well, it is an approach to thinking about and to implementing American foreign policy that combines an interest in improving the world through an increase in the number of democratic regimes on the assumption that democracies live in peace with one another, and so on the strength of the democratic peace argument, combines that goal with a determination to arm your diplomacy, recognizing that you're going to get pushback from the despotic or non-democratic countries in the world. And they, of course, by nature, use force to maintain themselves in power at home and are more likely to be willing to use force in relationships with foreign countries. So if you're going to negotiate with these countries, if you're going to deal with these countries effectively and have the goal of trying to expand incrementally and gradually, but nevertheless to expand the borders of freedom in the world, you're going to have to cope with countries that use force. And so you must, therefore, have a diplomacy that recognizes the value of the use of force in negotiations, not for the purpose of disrupting negotiations, but for the purpose of actually making negotiations succeed. And so that idea of conservative, meaning that you've got to back up your diplomacy with force, and internationalism, which means that you are interested in trying to eventually move beyond anarchy and the status quo and simply living and coexisting with despotic countries indefinitely, that constitutes the core of conservative internationalism. And it differs very specifically from the other three major traditions, from liberal internationalism, in the sense that liberal internationalists do not want to arm their diplomacy until the very end of negotiations. That is, only if the negotiations fail. So liberal internationalists are less focused on backing up their diplomacy with force unless the diplomacy at the end fails. Realists and nationalists, of course, do not want to pursue armed diplomacy or the balance of power for any other purpose than defense and security of a specific country. They do not think you can do much to change the character of the international system by increasing the number of democratic countries, and they doubt that democracy is potentially applicable in many countries in the world. So they're more content to live indefinitely in a world in which you balance power, divide up spheres of influence with other great powers, often non-democratic powers.
Yeah, thank you for explaining it that way. I think another thing that I liked about the opening of your book is the way that you play around with what conservative and liberal actually means in contemporary times. How you bring this about. I mean, the one part of your book where you talked about you had you were delivering a paper and somebody asked you a question right. about, aren't conservatives just about conserving essentially kind of the status quo?
Right.
Just for our listeners, how would you differentiate between conservative and liberal?
Well, I spent some time on that, even though many of my colleagues said that has to do with domestic affairs and doesn't belong in a book on foreign policy.
Yeah.
But in fact, it does, because we have had since the beginning of this republic two different schools of thought about the nature of freedom in America, and therefore, by extrapolation, a difference in view about the prospects of freedom in the world at large. I mean, we have had, all Americans are liberals. That is, they're classical liberals. We all believe in the Declaration, and in which is freedom for all. All men are created equal. And we believe in the Constitution, which provides for basic civil rights and basic equality. Now, we started out with a lot of equality among white males, but not very much equality elsewhere. But over time, we've expanded that idea. So we're all fundamentally committed to individual freedom and equality. All right? Unlike traditional, by the way, conservatism in Europe, which was associated with the monarchy and with the church, and with the forces that ultimately stood against the emancipation of the individual. So America was very unique in that respect. But there evolved two schools of thought about the nature of that freedom. One was the Jeffersonian school, which is today the Republican school, you could argue, of domestic affairs, a school that believes in limited central government, believes in a robust civil society, especially marketplace, and believes in a world in which individuals take as much responsibility as possible for themselves, all right, before they start trying to take responsibility for others. In fact, Jefferson made this point in a classical way in his first inaugural address. He said, some people say that man is incapable of self-government. He said, well, how then is he capable of governing others? So the point being, if you can't govern yourself, you have no business governing others. That's a limited government view of American freedom that has been cherished by conservatives. And I think Jefferson was the first great conservative. By the way, he was the first organizer of tea parties in America.
Yeah.
He literally started the party system in America. Now, the other view is the Hamiltonian view, also sometimes associated with John Adams. And that was a view about a stronger central government, about more central direction of the marketplace, more intervention by the government in the marketplace, more sort of responsibility on the part of government for individual society and for the evolution of sort of the individual culture. And that point of view has been represented over the years by the Whig, for example, party when it existed, by the Democratic Party by the Republican Party, I should say, in the context of the Civil War, when Lincoln brought national power to bear against the problem with slavery. And then since the Second World War, represented more by the Democratic Party and by what I call in the book social liberals as opposed to classical liberals. Now, once you, I try to define the very specific differences between the classical liberal and the social liberal, between the conservative and the liberal. By the way, most people don't disagree with the distinctions that I make in the book, namely that classical liberals believe more in limited government, social liberals believe more in activist government, and classical liberals believe more in the need to bring morality and religion and virtue to bear in public policymaking. Social liberals rely more on expertise and more on sort of the use of reason to try to develop solutions to problems, maybe even ultimately without having to rely upon any sort of moral or political point of view. Now, those views, I think, are deeply embedded in our country. As I said, it existed since the 1790s. I think both views are essential to a healthy and a balanced democracy. And so I applaud in that first chapter the fact that we now have a conservative movement in America, a so-called red state America, that is on an equal par, really, with the social liberal America or with the blue state America. And that's reflected now in the fact that the parties rotate pretty regularly back and forth in power. The Republicans just taking over again the Congress here in November of this year. We have to remember that for 60 years, from 1933 to 1995, the Republicans had held the House of Representatives for 4 years and the Senate for 8 years. The Democrats otherwise dominated during that entire 60-year period. We had a one-party system in America. So I applaud to some extent the partisanship that exists because we now have healthy, competitive, conservative, and liberal parties. And that matters not just in domestic affairs, it also matters in foreign affairs because conservatives are going to be more inclined to also oppose activist government in the international system, that is, oppose lots of international institutions and pooling and consolidating and even surrendering national authority to these institutions. They're going to be very skeptical of that. And they're going to also be more skeptical than liberals about the possibility that simply the evolution of science and technology and the progress of economics will resolve all the political issues for us and bring about democracy, for example, in the future without our having to engage the moral struggle with non-democracy.
Yeah, I want to return to that. That you raised some interesting points there when we near the end of the interview when we deal with kind of your recommendations for U.S. foreign policymakers moving forward. I think it's a good time to kind of go to transition from you lay out the ideas very well and use it as a way to move your book forward, but as a way to set up your case studies of, you know, conservative internationalism in action under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan. Chapter 3 deals with what you call, you know, the recent swings or the pendulum in U.S. foreign policy from 1991 to the present. I was wondering if you could briefly summarize what's gone on in, as far as foreign policy making in this country since 1991. Particularly, I'm interested in what your evaluation of George W. Bush.
Right. Well, in Chapter 2, I try to lay out clearly the four traditions. And then what I start to show in Chapter 3 is how the absence of the fourth tradition that I'm trying to establish, namely as conservative internationalists, how the absence of that tradition has led to cycling in American foreign policy between the liberal internationalists on the one hand and then the nationalists and the realists on the other hand. So what you see, because these being the dominant traditions, they've been kind of engaged in a tug of war with one another. And what you see in the presidents following now the end of the Cold War is you see a swing back and forth, all right, between these alternatives. And the reason the cycle occurs is because liberal internationalism encourages us to be engaged in spreading democracy, but it misleads us into thinking that we're not going to have to apply any significant resources in order to achieve that, especially military resources. So we go into the world as, for example, Bill Clinton did, all right, after the end of the Cold War, with this idea of democratic enlargement and economic engagement. We're going to spread democracy and we're going to spread prosperity. And you notice that in that slogan, which was, of course, Clinton's foreign policy, there's no mention of military, all right, defense or protection. The idea is it's going to be easy. History is on our side. We're going to bring all these countries, around to democracy and to prosperity, and the world is going to live in peace thereafter. Well, I mean, we were justified in having confidence in democracy and the capitalist economic system after the significant victory of those elements in the Cold War, but we were misled into thinking that there wasn't going to be some pushback. at some point from the continuing non-democratic forces. And, of course, eventually we got that. We got that in terms of all the ethnic conflicts that broke out in Yugoslavia and then in the Balkans. We got that eventually in the pushback that came from a more authoritarian Russia and China. And so pretty quickly, Clinton had to swing back from liberal internationalism to a more sort of realistic approach. All right, where he turned to NATO to try to help resolve the Bosnian conflict. He then, of course, conducted an actual war of bombing in the case of Kosovo under NATO auspices. He, of course, launched the first enlargement of NATO. He came back to the military side of policy by virtue of events that pushed him in that direction. When George W. Bush came into power, and some of the cycling, by the way, is caused by the politics. Obviously, a Republican president comes along, he's got to disagree with the foreign policy of the previous Democratic president. So George W. Bush came along and really reacted against sort of the liberal internationalism of Bill Clinton by opposing what he called his Mother Teresa foreign policy, his desire to intervene in problems all over the world and send diplomatic missions and efforts to try to resolve those issues, Haiti and other places. And he argued that we should have a more humble foreign policy. We should, in other words, be more limited in our thinking about what we can achieve in the world. He was actually advocating a, if not realist, maybe even nationalist orientation. That is, we should simply defend ourselves, take care of ourselves in this hemisphere. Other countries will take care of themselves. Our military forces should not be used for nation building, he said, in the context of the campaign in 2000, and we should concentrate on, you know, doing things here at home. He was going to be the compassionate conservative who had a domestic agenda. He is what I call in the book a reform conservative, that is, conservatives who believe more than any other group of conservatives that you can achieve some things by central government intervention. Now, 9/11 changed all that. He actually reacted to 9/11, I argue, in exactly the way you would expect a nationalist to react. Think of Andrew Jackson, the preeminent nationalist. I mean, George Bush reacted exactly the way Andrew Jackson would have reacted. He said, bring him on. By golly, you tread on me, and we'll take you on, and we'll crush you.
I was making the same point in class today about Jackson. I'm sorry. I was talking about him and used the same language. Go ahead, because I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, indeed. So I mean, he does. He goes out and he crushes them. And remember, mission accomplished? Now, maybe he, like a good nationalist, assumes that the problem's done. We can come home. Well, of course, the problem wasn't done. It was only half done. We had succeeded in the military side, but now we had to succeed on the diplomatic side. I mean, and if you want to be critical of George W. Bush, I think there are too many people who are too critical of George W. Bush, but you could criticize him on the follow-up. That is, in Iraq and Afghanistan. It wasn't the need to go into those countries to deal with the threat. We certainly know there was a threat in the case of Afghanistan because they attacked us on 9/11, or terrorists who were trained in Afghanistan attacked us. And you could argue at the time, as did many people in the majority of Congress and elsewhere, agreed that there was a threat in Iraq in terms of the possibility of the spread of weapons of mass destruction. Turned out to be based on bad intelligence, but you can't, you know, seems to be fault the decision made on the basis of knowledge at the time. So you can, I think, still argue that George W. Bush was correct in both of those interventions. But I think where he can be criticized is in terms of the follow-up. He was not as – he didn't react as quickly as his father did in 1991 to shifting from the use of force to the use of diplomacy. I mean, he didn't launch a Middle East peace initiative until 2007, 4 years after the invasion. By that time, we had kind of we had kind of squandered our military leverage. His father used the military leverage gained by the first Persian Gulf War to immediately convene a Madrid conference that eventually produced indirectly the Oslo Accords, the most significant progress we've made since World War II on the Arab-Israeli dispute. Now, the Oslo Accords didn't hold, but at the time, that was a big step forward. So Bush didn't make that shift quickly enough. Now, one consequence was that, of course, Obama comes along, and he says, in effect, that now, you know, Bush's problem was he thought he could solve every problem at the barrel of a gun, with the barrel of a gun. I'm going to do diplomacy and show you that I can raise the standing of America in the world and I can improve all of these problems around the world simply by focusing on diplomacy. Well, you know, Obama, of course, has now gradually realized, or he's in the process still, I think, of gradually realizing that what do you do when your partners don't negotiate? What do you do when your partners fight back with military force, like the Russians have done in Crimea and Ukraine, or like Iran is doing in Syria and Lebanon? You know, are you just going to give up and let them have their way, or are you going to have to push back? So Obama is now very late in his term, much like Clinton, is beginning to realize, you know, I've got to use some force here. He's now essentially restarted the war in Iraq and possibly started a new war in Syria. This is the man, by the way, who came into office determined by diplomacy alone not only to avoid wars but to end wars. And so he swung the pendulum, it seems to me, way too far over to the diplomacy side. It's now swinging back, you know, slowly, but in the next 4 or 5 years, possibly, especially if we continue to have some setbacks, as, for example, in the case of the spread of the Islamic State now in Syria and Iraq. I mean, they are now setting up training camps in that part of the Middle East to train terrorists to potentially attack us in Europe, exactly what the Taliban government did in Afghanistan in the years leading up to 2001 and to 9/11. So does this mean that we are potentially vulnerable to another attack? It may well. And as that reality, I think, it reemerges, then we'll see another swing back towards a recognition that you sometimes have to rely on force in order to back up your diplomacy, or else you're going to be simply defeated by your adversaries. And so there's that chapter three lays out this kind of cycling. Now, what I'm suggesting is that there's a possibility that conservative internationalism, which I then go on to illustrate in the case of four, you know, American presidents, that it could help us to find a middle ground between these the endpoints of our cycle. That is, we might be able to find conservative internationalism defines a way to stay in the world, all right, with still with the objective of trying to transform the world, but now disciplining that objective very carefully, all right, by setting priorities and by showing a willingness to compromise. But it also realizes from the very beginning that you're going to have to arm your diplomacy with force, because that's what the other side is going to do. And if you want them to take negotiations seriously, you're going to have to persuade them that they can't achieve their objectives by force outside the negotiations. And so the purpose of force, of armed diplomacy, is to make the negotiations succeed and not simply to let the adversary drag out those negotiations, all right, because you're now committed not to use force until the negotiations fail, if you're following the liberal internationalist tradition, and you cannot, and you're unable then to achieve any success inside the negotiations. Iran, for example, will negotiate with you forever until they achieve their objectives by force in Lebanon, in Syria, and potentially by acquiring a threshold nuclear capability. And then by the time it's apparent that the negotiations have failed, you're going to have to use a lot more force if you're going to stop them. Or more likely, you're just going to accept their advance.
Yeah, that's one of the arguments you make in the book, that a little force in, you know, in the present, often unrecognized, you argue, often it prevents larger uses of force in the future. And a lot of times that's not recognized because of the way history is written and how people in the past kind of look at it. But
yep. No, that's exactly right. I mean, there's a whole area there that is understudied in, you know, my field. That is, cases where it may have been, had we used a little bit of force early, we'd avoided, you know, catastrophic use of force later. I mean, the classic example of that, of course, is the 1930s, where had we confronted Hitler's advances sooner, we'd have avoided a world war in which 50 million people died, or we'd at least had a smaller world war. Now, I don't, you know, we don't really worry. I mean, we don't really examine that possibility the way we should. For example, Franklin Roosevelt gets a pretty, you know, clean pass on his leadership in the 1930s. When I'm thinking he was in office for 8 years, and then we get smacked at Pearl Harbor, and then lose 500,000 people, soldiers in the context of World War II. What was he doing for 8 years when he was in office while this threat was building in Europe? Well, you know, I don't know why we've never really kind of taken, you know, asked that hard question about Roosevelt's leadership, because had he been more responsive to these changes that were taking place in Europe, had he been more of an American Churchill in this period, we may have led the world and the American people. I understand they were isolationists at the time, but presidents are supposed to lead, not just follow. And he may well have brought about some smaller uses of force that would have headed off the Hitler, you know, Armageddon. Now, another example, by the way, which has never been studied, it blows my mind that nobody's ever asked this question. Had we been successful in the use of small force in the Bay of Pigs operation in early 1961, you know, when the CIA was assisting or was supposed to assist Cuban forces to overthrow the regime of Fidel Castro. Had we applied a little bit of air power to that operation, which we didn't do, but had that operation succeeded, we might have avoided the Cuban Missile Crisis, the closest the world has ever come to nuclear Armageddon. Why hasn't anybody studied that? Now, it's a tough thing to do, obviously, because when you use force early, you also risk a slippery slope. And so people are always saying, oh, no, don't use force. You know, that's just going to antagonize your adversary. It's just going to antagonize Hitler. It's just going to antagonize Tehran. Keep telling him force is, you know, a last resort, but keep negotiating. And yet when you do that and the other side doesn't refrain from the use of force, you run the risk that they will achieve their objectives outside the negotiations while the negotiations are still going on. And now you're confronted with an adversary that has taken most of Europe, in the case of Hitler, or an adversary like the Islamic State, who has now dominated the opposition groups in Syria. All right, opposition groups that we could have assisted potentially 3 years ago and might have built up a moderate alternative to the Islamic State. Now we have to use a lot more force bombing the Islamic State, and eventually we're going to have to put some boots on the ground, whether they're Kurdish boots on the ground or eventually American troops on the ground. It's the only way you're going to eventually secure the territory and make sure that they aren't setting up training camps to train terrorists to attack us or to attack Europe.
Yeah, you raised some interesting points there. And if you read the literature in any number of subjects, it seems to be at times when you talk about the use of force, it's always seen, I mean, maybe not to this level, but it's seen as warmongering, that at the end of the day, people are reasonable, that they can, negotiations can work. Essentially, human beings are, if for all the differences, are essentially capable of uniting on some issues and working things out. I see that kind of argument, our argument a lot.
All the time. Yeah, and it seems perfectly reasonable, and it's hard to refute. So I think one of the points that needs to be made, which is perhaps something on which both sides can agree, and that is that we should at least never negotiate from a position of weakness. That is absolutely critical to diplomacy, is making sure that your defense posture is strong. Now, this was, of course, a point that Ronald Reagan insisted upon. He was never opposed to negotiations. You know, it turns out, we know now, I knew it when I served under him, that he always wanted to negotiate with the Soviet Union, but he was not going to negotiate from weakness. And his view was that if we're strong enough, you know, we'll probably never have to use that force. They'll recognize it, and they'll understand that they can't beat us outside the negotiations, that they have to now work with us inside the negotiations. So, for example, today, I think we, you know, one possibility is to rally the American public around the idea that we've got to, we can't let defense keep dwindling away the way we have the last four, five, six, or eight, 6 years or so, especially under the sequester where we're cutting defense just arbitrarily across the board. That we've got to restore the military muscle, not for the purpose initially of any specific intervention. We're not going to use it in, you know, Syria or any other place. We simply want to have the best, strongest military capability as the basis for our negotiations. That's at least one thing I think that you could get the American people to support, all right, on the assumption, and I think it's a very good assumption, that the stronger America's strength has never caused a war, all right, and it's going to, you know, have the best chance of preventing us from ever having to use that force. There are two other sort of uses of force that become more controversial. And at the moment, at least, the American public is not willing to support it. I mean, one is to push back on the ground when your negotiating adversary tries to achieve its objectives outside the negotiations. All right, that's what Iran is trying to achieve right now in Damascus and in support of the Syrian Assad government. It's what Iran is trying to achieve by supporting Hezbollah and now essentially, you know, holding the lever of power in Lebanon. And it's what, of course, they're trying to achieve through the acquisition of a threshold nuclear capability in the confrontation with Israel. Now, there you need to have, I mean, I think if we're going to meet our basic interests in this area, which is to prevent them from training terrorists who can attack us, you're going to have to use some small force. And the earlier you do it, the better. And you have to, again, make this argument and convince the American people that, that, you know, if we had done this 4 years ago, we wouldn't be facing the Islamic State, probably. And today, we've got to do it unless we're going to face maybe an entire Iraq nation that is under the influence of this jihadist group known as the Islamic State. So that's a tougher sell, especially given the mood that the American people are in. But we ought to make it, and we ought to make it on the grounds that once we achieve that military leverage, once we succeed in taking territory back from the Islamic State, we don't intend to stay for 10, 20 years and build democracy. We intend to put a government, a little bit better government in place in those countries and get out. Be ready maybe to go back in 3, 4, 5 years later, but not stay for these long periods, all right, which we've done now in Vietnam, in Iraq, and Afghanistan. And in every one of those cases, after spending 10, 12 years, we're leaving those countries with governments that are no stronger than they were after 2 or 3 years. So we should have been out of there after 2 or 3 years. And that gives the American people some sense of the exit strategy, all right, for these interventions. So you go in, you take the territory back from the Islamic State, but then you pull out very quickly. You put that Syrian opposition group in power. Yes, they're going to be weak. Yes, there's a chance that they may fall apart. But you'll be back offshore, out of the area, and you can go back in. You'll be able 3 years later to convince the American people we have to go back in if there's a further problem. If you stay indefinitely, you're going to eventually exhaust not only the will of the American people, but you exhaust the lives of an unnecessary number of American military personnel.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you make a number of important points there. But to if you want to get people to buy into conservative internationalism, at some level you have to demonstrate its utility, and that's what I think you tried to do by the case studies, by showing how conservative internationalism has served U.S. interests well in the past. And you use Thomas Jefferson, James K. Polk, Truman, and Reagan. I was wondering if we could just, you don't have to go into all the details about them, but what makes each of these presidents a conservative internationalist and what they did successfully by following the tenets of that approach?
generally speaking, Jefferson has been considered a liberal internationalist in the sense that he believed in a new kind of diplomacy that would be pursued by republics like the United States that would eventually transcend the warlike anarchy of the world of monarchs. And presumably he wanted to achieve that new diplomacy without a lot of emphasis on force, kind of the classic definition of liberal internationalism. Well, my treatment of him suggests that he actually used a lot more force than people gave him credit for. He was indeed focused on, as an internationalist, he was focused on making the world a better place by spreading republicanism with a little R, if he could. That's why he supported the French Revolution, until, of course, Napoleon came along and a dictator took over. But he applied a lot more force than people give him credit for in his thinking about how you would spread republicanism in the world. I mean, he went to war with the Barbary states in the Mediterranean and spent 4 years fighting them, ultimately successfully, with almost the entire American Navy. I mean, like one or two ships were all that were left behind. He sent the rest of the naval force that we had at the time, maybe 12, 14 significant ships, he sent them to the Mediterranean to fight that war. Now, he did so because he understood that we had to protect our commerce and we had to demonstrate our ability to protect ourselves. We were a new country. We had relied upon British protection up till that point in the Mediterranean, and we had to be willing to draw the sword, as he said, or to show the rod to the Barbary pirates. So if that isn't a piece of force, I don't know what it is. Secondly, he was more clever in applying the use of force to securing the Louisiana Purchase than I think a lot of historians give him credit for. In other words, he did manipulate in the minds of the evidence, at least to me, suggests that he manipulated in the minds of Napoleon, in the mind of Napoleon and Talleyrand, he manipulated the possibility of a U.S.-British alliance, all right, which in the end wasn't the sole factor. But I think you can show that it was, in fact, the straw that broke the camel's back and ultimately led Napoleon, who did not want to get into another war with Britain and America in the New World while he was engaged in such a war in the Old World. It was the straw that broke the camel's back and caused Napoleon to decide to sell not just New Orleans and Western Florida, which is all that Jefferson asked for initially, but to sell the entire Louisiana Purchase. He also, by the way, made Napoleon aware the fact that American settlers were steadily moving towards New Orleans and that time was on our side, not on the side of the French, you know, administration in New Orleans. So he was, I think, much more subtle in his use of force than people believe, and therefore I think qualifies as a conservative internationalist. I mean, very quickly, Polk is one of the most underrated presidents, I think, in the history of the country, an extraordinarily ambitious man who in a sense was an accidental president, but came into office, had four major objectives, two domestic, two international. He accomplished them all in 4 years, and the two big international ones was to secure the Oregon Territory and to secure the Southwest Territories and finish the expansion of the country to the Pacific. And the thing about his diplomacy is that he never made a diplomatic initiative without backing it up with a military threat, and he never took a military initiative without backing it up with a diplomatic off-ramp for his adversary. And he does this repeatedly in the context of the war with Mexico. Now, you know, there's a lot of controversy about that war, and some people will never forgive him for being involved in that war. But a careful, I think, look at his policy shows how he was ready. He had very limited objectives to begin with in terms of the territory he wanted, and then he was very careful always in trying to match his military leverage with a diplomatic solution. And when he finally got that diplomatic solution, he compromised. We controlled all of Mexico in February of 1848, and there were a lot of people in Congress who argued that he should keep it, and we should train that we should build a nation, the democratic nation in Mexico. He was smart enough to know, look, I got the original territory I wanted.
you know, if I stay here for a long period of time in Mexico, I'm going to bleed to death. I better take this agreement and get out of here. In 6 months, he had the last American forces out of Mexico. And, of course, the agreement, history shown, was a magnificent, you know, sort of accomplishment. So that is his sort of qualifications, I think, as a conservative internationalist. Truman and Reagan, they were the bookends of the Cold War. Truman was really responsible for laying out the policy of containment, which said, in effect, look, we are confronting a nation here that is not only communist but atheist. That was very important to Truman, by the way. He was very conservative in terms of his, you know, kind of perspective on the world, which was infused by religious thinking. That wasn't true for FDR. So Truman was more quickly sort of, he more quickly came to the view that, you know, it's going to be tough to deal with these guys through negotiations unless we are just as strong as they are. Well, by 1947-48, of course, we had completely disarmed. We had demobilized, but the Soviets had not. And when, of course, then Berlin occurred, when the Berlin blockade occurred, that was the moment when Truman said, you know what, we're going to have to rebuild our defenses before we can negotiate successfully with the Soviet Union. And that was the beginning of the Cold War, but the beginning of an effort to try to establish a more balanced balanced relationship of arms. Took, by the way, 20 years for that balance to emerge. All right, but once it did, then the two countries, the two superpowers, were in fact more self-confident and able to negotiate with one another. We got the détente period of the early 1970s. So Truman, I think, unlike Roosevelt, probably realized sooner that it was going to take armed diplomacy in order to contain the Soviet Union and not simply jaw-jaw diplomacy, as perhaps FDR had hoped through the United Nations. Reagan, of course, revived that Truman understanding of what the Cold War was all about, that it was a contest between good and evil. It was a contest between two ways of life, one democratic and one dictatorial. And, of course, Reagan also believed that the only way you could negotiate effectively with the Soviet Union was to be as strong, if not stronger, than the Soviet Union. So he laid down the gauntlet to the Soviets and said, look, if you want an arms race, come ahead. We'll take you on. You can't win. And he basically scared the Soviets into negotiations. I think that's one way to interpret what happened in the mid-1980s. Gorbachev came along in part because the Soviets were so afraid of what was happening in the United States, where our economy was suddenly exploding and our military was taking off. And, of course, there was this prospect of, nurtured by the information revolution, there was this prospect of the Strategic Defense Initiative. And this just overpowered the Soviets. I mean, Gorbachev tells his colleagues already in the fall of 1985, he says, listen, the last thing we can afford is an arms race and an economics race with the United States. We'll lose. Well, there was the payoff of Ronald Reagan's buildup. And what was the result of it? Well, the result of it was the end of the Cold War that spread democracy. I mean, whether we wanted or they wanted, this whole silly argument about who won the Cold War, the fact is, after the war ended, democracy spread to some 63 countries in the course of the 1990s, and of course to all of the countries of Europe, so that Europe was now whole and free. I mean, that was an extraordinary sort of consequence, I think, of a foreign policy that seeks to spread freedom as possible and does so with a disciplined and a use of force and a willingness to compromise. And so those four presidents are at least examples. There may be others, and in future work, I hope to examine some other American presidents to see if they might qualify. But these four certainly seem to me to make a pretty good prima facie case that we've had this tradition in our quiver for quite a while.
What has been the reaction that you, as far as you can tell, about some of these arguments that you make about the conservative internationalist credentials of? What stuck out to me when I read this was when you write about Polk, about kind of using a counterfactual to explain why the Mexican American War in many ways served the United States interests well when the Civil War took place, and possibly preempting. Right. You use the term preempt possible dismemberment by European powers. Right. And Reagan's, I mean, this is, I mean, I was at the Schaefer conference last June, and the Reagan thesis was in the air, people debating Reagan's role in the end of the Cold War, and everybody was, you know, really down on the idea that Reagan played an important role into it. Right. So I'm just curious what you've kind of feedback you've got on those
arguments. Well, I mean, to be quite honest with you, I worry about whether or not this argument that I am making will have a big enough imprint on the debate, because there is a general desire, or at least from what I observe in the academic world, there's very little study of Reagan's policies. And the argument generally is that Reagan changed his mind somewhere along the way, and then Gorbachev came along and saved him. And I think the record does not, the declassified record now, which is reflected in a couple of very good books, one by Martin and Annalise Anderson called Reagan's Secret War, based entirely on the declassified NSC documents. I mean, it shows a totally different picture of Ronald Reagan. That he understood what he was doing from the very beginning. He had talked about this already before he became a politician. That is, in the early 1960s, he laid out much of his thinking about how you would take on the Soviets in a arms race, and then how you would be generous and magnanimous to them in negotiations, which is exactly the pattern he followed. And so I think we're just going to have to, some of us are going to have to keep talking about this and urging people to study the record and to observe the extent to which Reagan and these other presidents that I've looked at were willing to take small risks early in order to avoid much bigger risks later. And they did this by combining a willingness to use force, at least accumulate force, as Reagan did in his defense budget, with a willingness to negotiate, that is, to accept a less than perfect solution, like, for example, the INF agreement. You know, at Reykjavik, they wanted to eliminate all offensive weapons. Well, they didn't get the perfect agreement, but in 87, they were able to agree on the elimination of one type of weapon, the INF weapon. So he would take agreements when he could get them, not trying to solve all problems at once, but understanding that he would get those agreements only when he had, either equivalent or superior military leverage to that of the Soviet Union. So I'm hoping that the record can't be avoided. But, you know, here's one of the difficulties we face in a liberal academic world that is so unbalanced. You don't have many graduate students studying this stuff. I was out at the Reagan Library in the summer of this past year, and I'm told there isn't much traffic. Can you imagine the JFK Library not having graduate students in there studying all the memoirs over and over and over again? So this is a result of the fact that there aren't a lot of conservative faculty who urge their students to explore some of these topics. But my hope is that you, in the long run, you can't avoid the record. Although I'm aware of the fact that one way to avoid the record is just that way. That is, you avoid it. You don't examine it. It just sits there. And all the secondary literature simply echoes and reinforces the conventional argument that somehow or other, Reagan realized that his military buildup wasn't serving any useful purpose, and he decides to negotiate, and thank goodness Gorbachev comes along, and that's the end of the Cold War. I mean, this is we just can't have that one-sided argument about such an important event as the Cold War. I think it's in the interest of everyone in the academy, liberal or conservative, to make sure that we've examined the record from every conceivable point of view. And so that's what I'm advocating. That's what I hope the book can contribute to. In the end, I do believe in the public, I believe in the university, like Thomas Jefferson. I believe in education. I believe that people can be, influenced by the facts, and they can be best served by a debate that includes all points of view. We need that sort of debate about the reasons for the beginning and end of the Cold War, and we need that kind of a debate about the nature of the world that we face today.
Sure. Well, I mean, if it's any consolation to you, I think December 13th, I'm leaving for a 2-week trip to California, where I'm going to the Hoover Institution and to making a brief stop at the Reagan Library. And hopefully, if this is going to sound terrible, but hopefully I'm around. My sister's supposed to have a baby on December 12th. So hopefully I'll be around to see all of that baby and archives on my 2-week trip to California.
Well, that's wonderful. No, and when you're there, be sure you ask too about, you know, there's a Hoover Fellowship program that I was able to benefit from. And they are obviously interested in people who want to study Reagan. And a lot of the materials are at Hoover. The rest of them are down at Simi Valley. And so Hoover's one of those institutions that does want to balance this,
sure,
you know, the examination of this record over the next decades.
Yeah, I definitely will. I've already started to look into that. But, I mean, I've taken a lot of your time here today, and I appreciate it. But in conclusion, I wanted to pick your brain about how the insights you take from your study of conservative internationalism. I mean, you went over some of it at the beginning of the interview about the threats the United States faces today. In your last chapter, especially, you talk about the problems that the U.S. faces in the future in terms of its allies and jihadism and rogue states and authoritarian governments. What lessons do you think the United States should really pay attention to in the coming year?
Right. Well, as I say in the book, and as, in fact, conservative internationalism sort of lays out, you start with a pretty realistic assessment of the threat you face. And I think one thing we should realize is that we do not face a threat at this moment in the world that is equivalent to what the threat that the Soviet Union was. All right, we live in a much better world, even with all of its problems, than the world in which we were face to face with the Soviets for 40 years and could have blown up the world at any point in time, as we almost did in 1962. So that's very important. You know, conservatives sometimes want to maybe overstate the threat, just like liberals sometimes want to understate the threat. I think we need to be very realistic. All right, that threat that we face today is primarily the most immediate threat we face is the threat of terrorists trained to attack this country. So that means that when terrorists control territory, when terrorist states or terrorist groups like the Islamic State control territory where they can set up training camps to train terrorists to strike us, that's a very serious direct threat. So I would argue that that's the immediate threat we have to deal with. It's fundamentally the threat that we face in both Iraq and Syria, and we have to take it seriously. Now, taken by itself, that's not a – I don't think the Islamic State is anything to compare it, and its desire for a caliphate to the Soviet Union is just, I think, hyperbolic. So we should take it seriously for the real threat it is, that is, in terms of individual terrorists who might wind up over here and blow up another building or two or even a city, and address that threat. Now, secondly, though, we need to be aware of the possibility that those terrorists can, either by accident or by design, acquire weapons of mass destruction. This is, of course, the problem we face in Iraq, and it's the problem we face today in Iran and in North Korea. So that problem, namely rogue states and the spread of nuclear weapons and the possibility, even though, you know, this was discredited by the bad intelligence in the case of Iraq, but the possibility that those weapons of mass destruction might fall in the hands of terrorists, that has to be considered. That magnifies the threat, all right? And in that case, the focus is on Iran. What worries me at the moment, of course, is that Iran looks like it's going to become a nuclear power, and it looks like we're not going to do anything about it. Maybe Israel will at some point, although I think even Israel has maybe passed the moment when they could have done something about it militarily. Now, I'm not advocating war against Iran. I'm just saying that we face a serious problem. If Iran ultimately acquires a threshold nuclear capability, changes the whole dynamics of the relationship with Israel and changes the whole prospects in that part of the world and magnifies the possibility that terrorism could, you know, at some point gain access to some of this technology. Now, the same thing is true in Asia, It's less of an immediate problem, but clearly North Korea, we know, has been a proliferator of nuclear technology in the past. And to the extent that it has spread that technology to Pakistan and other places, it's a real threat, especially the prospect of that technology falling into the hands of terrorists. So that threat of rogue states, if it doesn't become connected to the terrorist threat, it's more manageable. If it does become connected to the terrorist threat, it is magnified. And finally, there's a third level of threat, and that is the major authoritarian powers of Russia and China. To the extent that they decide, either separately or collaboratively, to exploit the destabilizing effects of these rogue states, all right, Iran in the case of Russia, North Korea in the case of China, and decide that somehow or other they want to take advantage of the terrorist threat to undermine the liberal Western order and to push back against the liberal Western order. At some point, we could face a threat from those major authoritarian powers that would be the equivalent of the former Soviet Union. Now, China is the country we need to really watch in this regard, because it is growing very rapidly. It's made that decision to grow as an industrial power. Russia, I worry less about, because despite the fact that it's a big country and it has nuclear technology, it's still essentially an oil state. That is, a state that's heavily dependent upon resources, has not made some of the basic decisions that China has made to industrialize. But that's a looming possibility, that those authoritarian countries, and when you see the world in terms of conservative internationalism, you're always thinking about regime types. It's that combination that could really recreate a kind of Cold War threat. So what do we do? Well, you know, I think it's pretty obvious what we try to do now to deal with that. We've got to be serious about the threats to freedom on the borders of Russia and China. That's why the Ukraine problem is very important. That's why, of course, the future of the Korean Peninsula is a very important problem. I mean, those are critical areas that will determine whether or not Russia and China succeed in pushing authoritarianism forward, or whether we'll be able to hold the line and possibly push freedom towards them. And we've got we've got to have a policy that towards the Middle East, towards Iran, towards the Islamic State, ultimately towards Israel, that addresses the immediate threat, and that also works in some manner to stabilize that region. I think in the Middle East, by the way, we should be worried less about freedom, that is, because there's only one free country in the Middle East, and that's Israel. So we don't think of Iraq and Syria and those countries the same way we might have think of Ukraine, which is potentially a free state, or Turkey, or certainly South Korea, but that we think of them largely as states that have to be stabilized. And we do that through some of the measures that I've already suggested, plus trying to bring local countries into the equation more than we have in the past. And there I give the Obama administration some credit. That is, they've been very concerned about getting the Saudis, for example, and the UAE to step up and assist the bombing effort in the case of the campaign against the Islamic State. That's very important, just as Obama was, I think, effective in getting the British and the French and the Italians to step up in dealing with the intervention in Libya, although I think the intervention in Libya was not an essential intervention, whereas because no terrorists were being trained in Libya to attack us, they are now being trained in Syria to attack us, so Syria is a much more important problem. We shouldn't think too hard about spreading democracy in the Middle East. We should be thinking more in terms of stabilizing various situations, putting somewhat better governments into place. We clearly have to negotiate eventually some alternative government to Assad, and being in a position to both get in and out quickly in that region. All right, and not to commit forces to stay for 10, 12 years at the costs that we've incurred in the case of Iraq. And keep our eye on the ball where it matters most, namely on these major borders of freedom between free Europe and Russia, on the one hand, and free Asia and China, on the other hand.
Yeah, I see where you're going with that. You make an argument, I think, that runs through the book that, I mean, in the coming years, that there's perhaps more of a danger from the U.S. disengaging from the world and hoping for the best than actively trying to shape it and, you know, using force if necessary, which in my mind raises one of the issues that you deal with, or that you deal with and other scholars have dealt with, the issue of American decline. At the end of the day, people have talked about the, you know, from deficits to economic problems to the paralysis. We were talking earlier about the kind of healthy tension between the two sides in politics. Some people think that America at times is incapable of solving its problems because of, you know, congressional gridlock, right, and money in politics. I mean, at the end of the day, what do you make of these arguments of American decline and inability to kind of right its ship to, you know, keep that role of defending the global order?
Well, it's a very important point, and is really the question for the next generation. I wrote a book, in 1990, published by Oxford University Press, called The Myth of America's Decline. That was before, by the way, the end of the Cold War, and it was a response to Paul Kennedy's book, in which he had written, you know, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And he had predicted the fall, of course, of the decline of the United States. I predicted the decline of the Soviet Union. Well, I think I fared a little better than he did, at least over the last generation. But look, America has been in decline ever since 1945, and it has been a willful decline. That is, we have consciously designed a world, especially an economic world, in which other countries could become prosperous and could gain relative power with respect to us. I sometimes wonder if we aren't the first great power in the history of the world that has deliberately done that, deliberately designed a system that is designed to make others wealthy in the hope that they will become friends and maybe ultimately democracies. We did that obviously with Germany and Japan and with Europe and the free countries of Asia. We did it with the newly industrializing countries, Singapore and Malaysia. Now, Singapore is not a democracy, but some of these countries that came on, we at least made them wealthy. And in the case of South Korea and Taiwan, we also helped to make them democratic. And now we're doing it with the big monsters, that is China and India, with the big populated countries of the world. We're hoping to make them rich, and we're hoping that in the process they will become stakeholders and friends. Now, that's a remarkable strategy on the part of the United States. And it means in the long run that we actually want other countries to be as powerful and ourselves to be relatively less powerful. So one of the things we should, and by the way, it's worked pretty well so far. It's worked darn well so far. I mean, think of Germany and Japan. They're the core of Europe and Asia, core of free Europe and free Asia today. And those are the products of this kind of a policy after 1945. You know, you could be a little more skeptical about whether we're going to have as good a turnout in the case of China and India or Russia, where, as I say, really they haven't decided to enter the world capitalist economy yet. But it's extraordinary. We should realize that now. What it means, of course, is that we shouldn't get so upset about numbers, all right, relative decline. That's exactly what we want. What we should be thinking about is how do we sustain the liberal world order with the capitalist economy at its core? How do we sustain that over the next several decades as with partners, as others who have become more powerful now share with us more of the leadership role and more of the material costs? Now, the countries that you would look at in this case obviously would be the countries of the European Union and Japan. So one task for the next generation is to think about how we can slowly move those countries up along beside us in terms of giving them, sharing with them some leadership role, and getting them to invest more in both the economics and in the security of a liberal Western order. Now, that's a tall order, I understand, but it won't happen by design, but nevertheless, it's useful to conceptualize it. It's the equivalent of what happened when the British sort of passed a global leadership role to the United States. That didn't happen, by the way, without friction and without a lot of controversy. We obviously strongly oppose the British colonial system and lots of fights between, you know, Churchill, for example, and FDR during the course of World War II about that very issue. And so we'll have some fights with the European Union when this happens and with Japan. It's not going to, as I say, go exactly according to our, rule book. But we should exploit the fact that we have succeeded beyond the imagination of any former great power in creating a world in which more countries are wealthy and in which more countries are democratic. And now we need to think about how do we live in a world with those countries democratically. It's going to be an interesting challenge for the next generation of strategists to always keep that in the back of our minds, because if we're going to sustain this liberal Western order against challenges from countries like China and Russia, we're going to have to bring other countries into the loop. And by the way, that will also, I think, help to sustain the whole strategy with the American public, which is a little tired, obviously, of seeing American forces always taking the brunt of military actions abroad.
Yeah, I hear that. I teach a lot of veterans in my classes, and what you've just said is an argument, you know, that they make, at least privately talking to me.
Pull back. Absolutely. Let Europe fight its own battles.
Yeah.
Japan, you know, contain China. I mean, I think eventually that we're moving in that direction. But whether Europe is ready today to handle Russia on its own, I kind of doubt. And whether we should abandon Japan at this stage, when they're just beginning to kind of develop, an independence to sort of deal with China, I don't think so. I think we should hang in there for another generation. But with this objective of slowly passing the baton and moving those countries, closer up to our side. And here's where I say I can find a few things. I don't know what Obama's motivation has been. I think he's done this largely so that he can just withdraw and come home. But he has, brought some of the allies in the Middle East and in Europe into the, front line, so to speak. Now, he didn't sustain it in the case of Libya, and it's not clear whether the Saudis and the UAE are going to provide any boots on the ground. They probably won't. But you should always have that in mind. And by the way, if you're going to ask them to bear the costs, obviously they're going to have to be involved in the leadership. So that's the big trade-off, which, of course, a lot of people in the American policy process are going to resist, especially probably Pentagon strategists who want to kind of dominate the decision-making side, but they want to, of course, then get others to pay for the burden-sharing side. Well, it's not going to work like that over the long run. We're going to have to find ways to bring these others on board and give them a stake in the leadership as well as the burden-sharing.
Well, a lot of what you said, I mean, I don't want to take that much more of your time, but you use a term, I believe in Chapter 8, called the importance of a unipolar identity to the world order. And it matters that, this is a liberal world order as opposed to a liberal order of other countries with other values, which I think one of the reasons to read this book as well, beyond grappling with the arguments, is if, from my perspective as a historian, it does a good job of kind of entering debates about how historical change takes place, the tensions between ideas and material forces, kind of mixing in theory with historical analysis. And I'm right. Just wondering, as a historian, what has been kind of your general reaction to how polyscientists, have interpreted this book and kind of, the debates we have between, how to explain change using, history methods or, the infamous and from historians' perspective, the, independent variables, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I think it's an excellent question, Christian, and it's actually something I'm focused on at the moment with a little paper that I did for the political science convention in September and thinking about further. And that is, you know, normally we don't like explanations of events. Neither political scientists nor historians like explanations of events that rely too heavily upon the causal role of ideas or ideology. Generally, they say, oh, you know, you can't, well, what do you mean by ideas? And how do you measure ideas? You can't measure any of these things. So what do? We generally look at things we can measure, which means material resources. That's military and economic power. And so we often analyze things then in terms of relative power. Or we look at institutional rules and relationships and processes, all right, which are also more empirical or more measurable, we think, than ideas. So most of the time we come up with explanations, and that's true now about the explanations of the end of the Cold War. I mean, the two dominant explanations have to do with material constraints and material institutional constraints. The liberal internationalists like to think of the causes of the end of the Cold War in terms of the triumph of liberal institutions, that is, the triumph of, détente and Helsinki, and the cooperation that was generated, all right, by those processes, eventually leading the two sides to sort of realize that they could work together, solve their problems peacefully, and sort of surmount their military competition. All right, and that's a favorite argument, by the way, obviously, in our profession at the moment. But there's a second argument that has, it says, in effect, that, look, I mean, what went on here was a material competition, and it just so happened that the West used its economic and military resources more effectively. That is, it was more efficient. It was able to convert sort of raw power into usable power, and eventually it superseded the Soviet Union and ultimately displaced the Soviet Union. Now, that's a pretty hard-nosed, kind of realist explanation, and it's popular among, you know, some historians and some political scientists, but there's hardly any, you know, body who explains the Cold War, the origins and the end of the Cold War, in terms of sort of the ideological competition that was going on. It wasn't so much the material competition, because you have to ask the question, what motivated the material competition? Why was it that the West was so much more efficient economically and militarily? Well, it may have had something to do with democracy. It may have had something to do with the way in which they inspired their publics to defend, first of all, to express, and then to defend their freedom, ultimately to produce material and economic wealth in defense of that freedom, and maybe ultimately in the spread of that freedom. We know that the Soviet Union had lost its morale totally by the end of the 1980s, so it couldn't inspire its people to do anything. So maybe ideas ultimately drove the material competition and interpreted what was going on in the institutional relationships, that is, in the negotiations. So I'm focused on trying to look at our political science literature to see what work has been done on trying to operationalize ideological factors, ideas, as causes of events that occur in the world, and maybe not as immediate causes, but as causes over time. And so I titled this piece that I did for the American Political Science Association convention, Ideas Create Constraints. All right, because we normally start with constraints, but we never ask the question, where those constraints come from? Who created those constraints? I mean, when the Soviet Union, when that Politburo met in the fall of 1985 and Gorbachev said, hey, we can't compete with the Soviet Union, with the United States, because we'll lose. What was he looking at? He was looking at new constraints that Reagan's ideas had created. Had he been talking to them in 1979, I don't think he would have said that, because the world seemed to be going in the Soviets' direction in 1979. But suddenly, Reagan came along, had a different set of ideas, created a set of policies, put into place new constraints, and now those constraints did, in fact, constrain Soviet options. So there isn't a lot of work on this. I mean, a couple of colleagues like John Owen at the University of Virginia, Mark Haas at Duquesne University, Dan Silpot at Notre Dame University. A few people are working on this, trying to figure out empirical ways, and they have done so of operationalizing ideological factors and showing how they occur before changes take place in either material power or institutional factors. And so in this way, trying to strengthen this strand of thinking, I wouldn't argue that it's the only way to think about the causality of events in history or in international politics, but it's one way. And oddly enough, we are all liberals in the academic world who believe in critical thinking and who believe in the importance of ideas, and that's why we dedicate our lives to education, and yet we don't study. We don't have a framework for studying how ideas actually move events. We say, oh my gosh, when somebody has ideas that are inconsistent with contemporary events, we say, oh, that person's ideological. Oh, that person is kind of off the charts. He's off the map. That's what they said about Reagan in 1981. No, pay attention to what those ideas are, to what extent these leaders are successful in implementing those ideas. You have to obviously translate them into policies. Reagan had to translate his ideas into a defense budget and into an economic program. But look at how that's done. Look at how then the consensus is generated on that. And then look at the impact that those programs, those policies have on material and institutional constraints. Now you've got at least a reasonable framework for assessing the causal impact of ideas. So we have a lot of work to do in this area in the academic world, because for some reason, even though we all believe in ideas, we don't really systematically study them and their causal effect.
Well, I'm glad you raised that. I was going to ask you what your future plans are for your future projects. But what you said reminded me of how I deal with students. And I think this is for America in general. We tend to, at least when I talk to people, they tend to dismiss things and call things crazy when they don't really know what they are. And they don't really study the idea or what animates the idea. Like I had a class just a couple of days ago. I was Osama bin Laden came up and somebody said, he's nuts. He's crazy. What a psychopath. And they had really no idea what he argued. They had no idea what his ideas actually were, why he was mad at America, what he didn't like about American society and foreign policy. It just kind of made him,
more
comfortable without dealing
with ideas to personalities.
Yeah.
So they did that, of course, with Reagan, too. Oh, it wasn't his ideas. It was his personality. You know, he just was a likable guy. That's why people voted for him, et cetera. This is really quite, misleading and unfortunate. And we need to get away from this idea that when somebody thinks of something or comes up with a set of ideas that do not match the existing reality, that we immediately label them ideological. Mm-hmm. Because that's the moment when, for example, Reagan, 1981, that's the moment when we should be paying attention to their ideas, not dismissing them. Because if they succeed in implementing them, then they can actually change the realities. And it's a very different way of thinking about the role of ideology than just to dismiss it as sort of out of place.
Yeah.
That doesn't conform with what's going on. Oh, he's ideological. Oh, you know, his ideas really don't matter. It's more his personality or other factors at work.
Yeah, when I taught high school for a year, one of my colleagues could not talk about Reagan. The first thing he said over and over again was, Reagan, amical dunce. thing he said.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he forgot he'd even said it before. Like, he just liked that punchline.
It's a quick way. It's a quick way to dismiss, things that you don't know anything about. it's unfortunate, very unfortunate. We should, anytime people attribute things to either idiocy or luck or anything like that, I always say, that's kind of the last refuge of scoundrels. If you can't think of any better explanation than that, don't even bother to, offer an explanation.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I've taken up enough of your time. I'd want to thank you again for speaking with me about
Well, I've enjoyed it very much. You obviously read it Read the book with some care, and I really appreciate that. And, you know, let me know if I can be of any further help, and I'll look forward to seeing the podcast at some point.
You have been listening to Christian Peterson interview Henry Now on New Books in World Affairs. We hope you join us again and the very near future. Have an excellent day.